I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. According to the Obama administration, its healthcare website is a vastly better experience for consumers than it was 2 months ago. The response time is reportedly improved. The system is said to be more stable, with a promise that 80% of users will be able to sign up. The real test of the system is now underway to see whether these predictions pan out and how well the site works at the back end. The Affordable Care Act is the signature legislation for President Obama and has had a rocky debut since it became law from critics on both the left and the right. Today on Radio Times, we get an update and a reality check on the health care law, and we have two guests who have joined us. Sarah Cliff covers health policy for the Washington Post, also provides a regular look at how the Affordable Care Act is changing the American health care system at her blog called Health Reform Watch. And Sarah Cliff, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us is Robert Field, someone we have called on a number of times as we have been talking about the Affordable Care Act. He's a professor of health management and policy at Drexel University School of Public Health. He's also a lecturer in health care management at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania, author of a brand new book called Mother of Invention, How the Government Created Free Market Health Care. And Robert Field, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Sarah, let me begin with you. And begin with, I guess, a conversation you had with other reporters yesterday with the Obama administration. Sounds like they're pretty confident that at least at the front end for the consumers, that the site has been improved.
They are, and this is a deadline that the administration has been working towards, a self-imposed deadline that they set a while back, saying that by the end of November that they expected the website to work smoothly for the vast majority of users, and they define vast majority as in the zone of about 80%. And the administration announced yesterday they believe they've met that goal. Unfortunately, it's a little difficult for us as reporters or really any outsiders to verify that metric. We don't have polls that we can put out in the field of people using this to get a sense of how well it's working. But I have been doing a few interviews with shoppers yesterday and today, and it seems like there are still people having trouble, but there are others who, as of yesterday, got through for the first time and were able to enroll. They spoke with one gentleman in Florida who said he'd tried upwards of 100 times and just yesterday was able to sign up. So it seems like some people are making it through, but I think as people return to the website, they start hearing that it's fixed. We're going to see a bit of a test of how well it goes on this almost a relaunch of the website right now.
Well, Robert Field, you were one of those people that tested out the website yesterday. How did you do? Or how did the website do?
I did fine. The website did fine, too. I was able to get on to the page where you create an account. The page is loaded quickly. I went from there to a page asked for help, listing navigators in my zip code. That worked fine. So I think this front end is vastly improved. I'm sure we'll continue to get stories about people experiencing glitches and breakdowns and so forth. But you see that with any new website. Amazon, Google, they've all had problems like that. The problem now is that back end.
Right.
We can enter the information, but does it get to the insurance companies? And that's crucial because if they don't get the information, they can't set up an account.
Sarah, let me go back to you and help us understand what that back end involves or entails.
Sure. So each time someone selects a plan, the website is supposed to fire up a file, and this is known in insurance speak as an 834 transmission.
Right.
I do not know why it's called 834 transmission, but that is the file that gets sent off. And when the website launched, insurance companies were saying that these had a lot of errors. One example that got circulated around was some man who was showing up as having three wives, and he was not a polygamist, but the coding was wrong, that his children were being coded as spouses. And a lot of the fixes that the administration has worked on, and they've been very forthright about this, are for the consumers, to make the consumer experience work better. That's been at the expense of working on back-end fixes. There's only so much bandwidth the administration has, and they've chosen to focus on the front end. And the insurance industry, America's health insurance plans, did tell one of my colleagues at the Post yesterday that they're a little bit worried about the information that they're getting. If the website is working, the floodgates open, all of a sudden they're getting lots and lots of enrollments, they're a little bit nervous that the information they're getting might not be right, and they really need that to be right in order to send out medical insurance cards and start paying claims in January. So I think that's going to be the next thing we're watching is this information getting sent to insurance companies accurate, and are people signing up for the plans they think they're signing up for.
What will you be watching for, Robert?
I think the real risk is January 1st. If they don't have information on who's covered, what happens when the claims come in? Are people going to get claims denied because the insurance companies don't think they issued a policy? That's a real problem, and that back-end stuff is crucially important. So we'll be seeing after the first of the year if that arises.
But would it be fair to say, from your perspective, Robert Field, that if they've fixed much more of the front-end experience and they can focus now on this back-end experience, or is that even more complicated?
Presumably, yes, they can now focus on the back end, but apparently there are pieces of that that they haven't even started building yet, and they have under a month to get that working.
Wow.
So, and of course, the front end is working much better, but it's far from perfect. So this is going to be a real challenge. People may feel more satisfied. We'll have fewer stories in the press about frustrated people trying 100 times, but what they've got to make sure is that we don't have stories in the press about people going to the hospital and then there's no record of their coverage.
And how important to the Affordable Care Act, Robert, is this Gov healthcare site where people are signing up for insurance?
So it's one of many pieces of the Affordable Care Act. Others have gone into effect. The Medicaid expansion is expected to cover almost as many people as these new insurance exchanges. We have the consumer protections, the 20-somethings who are now back on their parents' policies, the end of coverage limits. We have these new creatures called accountable care organizations, which are going to hopefully revolutionize the payment structure for healthcare. That perhaps it has something to do with a low rate of increase in medical costs recently. But these exchanges go to the heart of what the Act is meant to accomplish, which is to tell all Americans, if you want coverage, you're guaranteed to be able to get it. So from that point of view, this is crucially important.
And Sarah, I'm wondering whether it was a serious design problem in getting this site up and running, or whether we're trying to connect all the pieces of an enormously complicated healthcare system, or maybe a combination of the two.
I'd say a combination of the two. And if you look at a report the White House put out yesterday, they had a pretty scathing indictment there of how the project was initially managed. They put out this report talking about all the ways the website had improved, but it also talks about all the ways that it did not work when it launched. And some of the things they cite are really poor management. There was not really someone running this show very effectively. A lot of testing that should have happened but didn't. That there were really a lot of problems that, hindsight is obviously a little bit easier to look back, but that the White House is now citing as reasons why this didn't initially work. And it is a very complicated endeavor. Trying to expand insurance to ultimately 30 million people is something we haven't done since the 1960s when we created Medicare and Medicaid, and even that was a lot simpler because that was signing people up for a government program, whereas here you're trying to enroll people into private insurance. So it certainly was a complicated endeavor to take on, but it was also, the White House, will say and has said that they believe it's part of their management that led to the launch going so poorly.
Does that mean Kathleen Sebelius and Health and Human Services, or the president himself, or someone else in the government, Sarah? As a sort of ultimate person responsible for the system?
Kathleen Sebelius has said before, hold me responsible, that kind of the buck stops here. The president has said similar things. A lot of the management of this project was in the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. They're the ones who really oversaw the building of healthcare.gov. I don't expect at this point we're going to see anyone asked to resign or step down or anything like that. But I think there's a pretty widespread acknowledgement that this was not managed in the way it should have been.
You want to add to that, Robert?
Yeah, well, I think the fact that we don't have someone who's going to get fired for this is part of the problem, because no one was really in charge. There should have been one person who was overseeing this as a logistical project, and they would coordinate all these many, many moving parts. And it seems as though there were no clear lines of authority, that many of the contractors didn't know who to report to, that a lot of the government officials put stock in the companies and the contractors who didn't come through. And I think that in and of itself shows how poorly organized this was. Obama is the overall president. He can't get into the weeds of this. On the other hand, if he were the CEO of a corporation, he would have to have lines of authority and accountability. And apparently that didn't happen here.
And Sarah, this all has to connect to the IRS as well, right? To figure out whether people get these subsidies or deductions.
Right. That's a little bit down the line, but this is going to be another crucial test of the healthcare law. Is the Internal Revenue Service does manage the individual mandate. They are the ones that check if you have health insurance, and if not, they would be the ones to apply a penalty. And the IRS is also does some of the work to determine what size subsidy people get based on their income, because the Internal Revenue Service has a lot of that data on how much people are earning. And so far, they've been doing pretty well at the part of calculating premium subsidies. We're going to see how well they do on administering the individual mandate. I've done a little bit of reporting there, and they're in a bit of a tough spot because their budget keeps getting cut as they take on this really big new task of checking if every American in the United States has health insurance.
Yikes.
So it's challenging, and that's another area we're going to be watching in the year to come.
Well, and even picking up on that, Robert, how much do you think the problems of the healthcare.gov site or even the Affordable Care Act is a result of either funding problems or the critics of the site? There have been critics on both the left and the right. Oh, I think the critics on the right have been more vocal in their opposition, and a number of them in Congress as well.
Right, right. So that definitely has something to do with this. They've been swimming upstream all along. For one thing, they have to set up sites for 36 states. They had never expected that. They expected all but a tiny handful of states to set up their own. So that increases the scale of this tremendously. And then in terms of funding, that has to do with political opposition, that their opponents in Congress have cut funding for them. So they've had a bigger task with less funding, and that definitely has something to do with it. On the other hand, they have had 2 to 3 years to plan for this, and there was this management organizational failure on top of that. What they could have done was to double down, realize the challenge, and handled it in a more organized manner.
Do you think, and Sarah, about a minute away from our first break here, this is, of course, rolling back the clock 2 months, but whether they, if they had delayed the debut of this website, would that have created a kind of political pushback or even a bigger one than they experienced in the last 2 months?
I think it would have been a challenge to delay it, and especially in the past few months, it would have been logistically just about impossible to delay it. You had insurance companies who for years have now been working this into their business plan. They were counting on the exchanges to launch this October to say, actually, we're going to wait a year, or we're going to wait 6 months. I think you'd see a lot of really aggressive pushback and frustration from healthcare communities that have put years of planning into this. So even, you know, put the politics aside for a moment, logistically it just was not possible this year to delay the launch of the Affordable Care Act.
And that is Sarah Cliff. She covers health policy for the Washington Post, joining us by telephone. Also with us here in our Philadelphia studio is Robert Field, Professor of Health Management and Policy at Drexel University School of Public Health. We are talking about the Affordable Care Act and the fact that the healthcare.gov website has been under construction and debuted this weekend as reportedly new and improved. Taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
1812 Productions, Philadelphia's all-comedy theater company, supports WHYY. From the creative team that brought you This Is the Week That Is and our show of shows, 1812 Productions celebrates the holidays with its newest original production, The Big Time, New Vaudeville for the Holidays, featuring Jennifer Childs, Scott Greer, and Dave Jadico. The Big Time reunites Philadelphia's comedy dream team and brings the steamer trunk circuit into the 21st century. Tickets at 1812productions.org.
Medical bills can cause serious sticker shock.
What? I'm paying all this for what?
Why do those procedures cost what they cost?
Because you called a CAT scan a $6,000 expense, it doesn't make it so.
I'm Maiken Scott on the first episode of The Pulse, How to Untangle Medical Bills. Also, a doctor reveals a secret.
When I found out the next day, I was horrified.
The Pulse, Friday morning at 9, new on WHYY.
Made possible by AstraZeneca and Independence Blue Cross.
Next time on Here and Now, with interfaith marriages on the rise, more parents are raising kids with multiple religious traditions, which isn't always easy.
Your children are interfaith children, and they are going to have to defend their identity, no matter what it is.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We're getting a reality check and an update on the implementation of the new health care law, the Affordable Care Act, and the troubled website, which has been under construction for the last couple of months. And according to the White House, it is vastly improved. Again, our guests are Sarah Cliff. You can read her blog, Health Reform Watch. Robert Field also has a blog called The Field Clinic, and you can read that at philly.com. He also has a new book called Mother of Invention, How the Government Created Free Market Healthcare. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Robert, let me go back to you, because some of the critics of the Affordable Care Act are on the left, and they are the ones who are saying we should have a single-payer system, we should have Medicare for all, for a whole host of reasons that did not happen. Do you think we'd be in the situation we're in today if we had gone down that road?
If we'd gone down that road, assuming it's politically possible, we would have problems of some sort. Just to say single payer doesn't mean it all automatically works out and all the gears are greased. Even Medicare took a while to get up and running. You remember the addition of the Medicare prescription drug benefit was a rocky rollout. Medicare actually has private insurance companies woven into its fabric, even to administer the government-run system. But I don't think we'd have problems like this. You know, if you're going to address the problem of the uninsured, you can go with a private sector solution or a public sector solution. The private health insurance sector is so complex, even without adding the Affordable Care Act on top, that you're going to wade into difficult, murky waters no matter how you approach it, and you're sort of guaranteed to have this problem. The problem is that politically, it would be very difficult to go the other route.
Do you agree with that, Sarah?
I do. I think, you know, politically, going through a single-payer system was pretty much a non-starter in Congress. That just wasn't one of the options that was on the table to pursue. And I think, you know, to Robert's point, it is any time you make a really big change to the healthcare system, it is very complicated and gets very challenging. You know, one of the ways I've thought about it is if, you know, we did implement a single-payer healthcare system, if you imagine, you know, the cancellation notices that went out to a few million people in the individual market, those would be going out to every single American saying, you know, your insurance is canceled and you're moving to this new program. If you think about the frustration and, you know, political outrage at, you know, a few million cancellation notices, think about hundreds of millions of cancellation notices and how people would be reacting right now. So I think, you know, with something that's one-sixth of our economy, there's never an easy way to make really big changes to it.
Well, yeah, go ahead, Robert.
One of the things that's really interesting is the history of this, which I outline in the book. Back in the 60s when Medicare was created, it was seen by its supporters as the first step towards coverage for all, towards a single-payer system. That goal has continued to exist. Virtually every president, including Ronald Reagan, has endorsed it, but the mechanism has switched towards more and more of a private sector focus. Richard Nixon was actually the first one to come up with the idea of an individual mandate to counteract the adverse selection, the messing up of the risk pool. That idea gradually gained traction. The Clinton plan in the 1990s was very private sector oriented, and now the Obama plan tries to build almost entirely on the existing private structure. So there's an irony in that both sides, even many Republicans, have come around to saying we should have coverage for all, but now the Democrats are saying let's do it the private sector way, which turns out to be very complex.
Sarah, let me ask you about, and Robert as well, about those people on the, I guess, had individual insurance that lost it. The president said that they could keep those plans for the next year. And it was how many people, Sarah, that received those, I guess, those letters in the mail?
Oh, we don't know for sure, but we think it's around 7 to 12 million people, somewhere in that ballpark.
And the president did say at least temporarily they could hold on to those plans. I guess if their insurance company would stand by them?
So it's a two-step process. The president did say that insurance companies can keep offering these plans that are not compliant with the health care law, and the federal government would not penalize them, that they would not get in trouble for offering these non-compliant plans. But two things have to take place before someone has that option. First, the state insurance regulator, which is known as the insurance commissioner, has to agree that, yes, it's okay to sell these plans. Mm. Each state has a different regulator, and they've really split on this issue. We see, you know, a pretty even split between states that are allowing these non-compliant plans to be sold in 2014 and states that are saying, you know, we're going to stay the course. We don't want to change this. If the state regulator signs off, then the next decision comes from the insurance plan that has to decide, is it a good business decision for me to offer this insurance plan to my subscribers? So it's not an automatic process of all the cancellations getting reversed. It's really very much a case-by-case process, and folks who have received a cancellation notice should probably keep an eye on their inbox and see if they're getting something from their insurance carrier informing them of what's happening to their plan next year.
And as we all know, Robert, the president was criticized because he was out there on the stump basically saying, if you like your plan, you can keep it.
Right, right. Now, supporters would say that's an exaggeration because the vast majority of people will be able to keep essentially their existing plan, although they will almost all be better. Coverage will be enhanced in some ways. But the other side said he lied, he misrepresented it, that there is a substantial portion of the population that won't be able to keep their plans. Now, one thing that I think is getting lost in the debate is for every person who complains that they want to keep their old coverage, there are some number of people who are absolutely thrilled. They've been waiting for the day that they can drop these skimpy plans and get real insurance on an exchange, people who have pre-existing medical conditions, who are older, and so forth. We don't know what the ratio is, but there are a substantial number of people who are just thrilled to move on to other policies.
Because these were, at least a fair number of them, were pretty lousy plans and didn't meet the requirements of the Affordable Care Act, right?
Many of them were sort of not mini meds, but micromeds. They would have high deductibles, $2,000 or $3,000, and then more importantly, low annual caps. So they'd only cover maybe $5,000 or $6,000 total. So you're insuring a very narrow window of expenses, and they're not really protecting you from the threat of financial ruin if you get sick. That and the fact that they have lots of exclusions, which the new plans won't.
Sarah, anything you want to add to that? Then I do want to get to some of our callers.
Yeah, you know, I think Robert is exactly right that, you know, we're seeing a lot of change in the insurance market right now, and for some people that change will be positive. They'll get more benefits. People who were not able to even get into the market, about 20% of people who apply to the individual market right now are rejected for pre-existing conditions, that they will see things improve. But if you are young and you are healthy and you've been buying a really skimpy plan that you like, you're probably going to be frustrated with some of these changes. And, you know, that's one of the pushbacks you do see is people saying, I don't want to purchase this plan that has more benefits. And I think we're going to see this all shake out over the next few years, but there clearly are some winners and some losers in this process.
And the system needs these young, healthy people, right, Sarah, in order to be able to cover the rest of the population that wasn't insured.
It does, definitely. So the White House estimates that they expect about 7 million people to sign up this year, and they think they need about 2.7 million of those, about 40%. To be under 35. And the reason those young people are so important to the healthcare law is they tend to have lower costs, and that helps keep down premiums for everyone else who is signing up. So really getting young people to buy insurance is crucial, and we're still waiting. We don't have demographic information yet on who is signing up, but that's one thing that'll be very interesting to watch.
Yeah. Go ahead,
so
Rob.
This puts even more pressure on the website, because the worst scenario is people who get policies canceled and then can't sign up for the new coverage even if they want to. So that's yet another reason that they've got to get this up and running.
And this is a more, I guess, a psychological question, but I'll toss it to you, Robert, which is, how do you get young, healthy people that think they are invincible to sign up for health insurance?
Well, you try many ways. Actually, there is somewhat of a misconception that none of them want insurance. I have two sons who are in this category. They are very thrilled to be insured. A lot of young people actually couldn't get coverage because they didn't have jobs. The individual market was too difficult. So a lot of them want to be in it anyway. I think a lot of cajoling. They're doing a new advertising campaign. Your mom wants you to have insurance. And then the penalty, which will be very low at first, but eventually will ratchet up to the point where it may induce them to get the coverage.
And Sarah, what seems interesting to me, and you're closer to it certainly than I am, is that there still seems to be a lot of interest in the site. There still is demand, at least. I don't know if people are just window shopping or whether they're actually shopping when they go to the website.
Yeah, and one of the best ways to measure this is actually if you look at the state exchanges. There are 14 states that are running their own marketplaces, and they tend to have had a better launch than the federal government. Some of them have had trouble getting off the ground. But if you look at California, Washington State, Kentucky, those are three states that have had really easy launches where people have had good access to the website. And you see pretty robust enrollment numbers. California has had about 80,000 people sign up for private insurance plans so far through their exchange. And when you look at those states, what they seem to suggest is that demand is there, that if you have a functioning website, as you do in Kentucky and California and Washington, that people will go buy those products. So that's what we've learned from the state exchanges, and it suggests that some of the problems with the federal website and the reason you've seen pretty low enrollment is that it's a technical mm-hmm. challenge. And I think one of the things, as these technical challenges get resolved, we're going to learn whether the states having robust enrollment, whether those are an anomaly or those are really what other states would have looked like had the federal government had a pretty functional website in October.
Let me reintroduce you both. Hold on 1 second. I want to make sure our listeners know who we are talking to in this hour of Radio Times. And again, getting a kind of a reality check, an update on the Affordable Care Act, the launch or the relaunch of the healthcare.gov website. And again, Sarah Cliff covers health policy for the Washington Post. You can read her blog, Health Reform Watch. Robert Field is a professor of health management and policy at Drexel University's School of Public Health. You can read his new book. It's called Mother of Invention. Also, he's got a blog at philly.com called The Field Clinic, and we do have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Let me get some callers in. We have, looks like, Edna from Manahawkin, New Jersey. Edna, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have two questions. One, were the people that were working on the development of the website shut down during sequestration? Number two, if you are working on a website that you feel is going to be canceled by Congress, where's the mindset? It's like painting your house with the knowledge that it might be knocked down.
Well, and then let me toss that first to Sarah, and I saw Robert Field shaking his head no, but Sarah, go ahead.
So what we know is that most of the people working on the website were not shut down by sequestration, that the Health and Human Services has said repeatedly that those people were considered essential, and they stayed on and they kept working. But one thing you actually do see in some of the notes that have been released from meetings at Health and Human Services, meetings of people working on the website, is there are certain support departments they were not able to get in touch with because of sequestration. So there are certain times when there's something they needed help with, that it'll show up in the notes that, oh, that person is on furlough because of the sequester. So it probably was a small factor, and not, you know, I don't think it's really a good way to explain why the website launch went so poorly, but it sounds like it certainly didn't help and might have hurt just a little bit.
We got a tweet from Nick, and this is for you, Robert. Why is Wall Street involved in healthcare at all? Mm-hmm. Why can't all health-related organizations be nonprofit? Kind of, this is, in a sense, what you look at in your new book.
This is exactly what I look at in the book, that we have the most private sector-oriented healthcare system in the world. It's one of the reasons it's so expensive. And as it has evolved, the private interests that we've created, the hospitals, the medical specialists, the drug companies, the insurance companies, just get more and more powerful and want to protect what they have. So as we go further and further along, it gets harder and harder to repeal that. Mm-hmm. That actually may work to Obama's benefit, because you now have these private interests that have a stake in the success of the Affordable Care Act, and they're going to put pressure on Congress to keep it, or at least keep some form of it. But I think at this point, we're too far down the road to go back again.
But would you say that these private industries owe the federal government a hearty thank you for helping them create what appears to be very profitable businesses?
I absolutely think so. And again, that's the theme of the book, sort of pushing back against the objection to Obamacare that keep the government out of our health care. The government weren't in our health care, we wouldn't have most new drugs because the NIH funds the basic research. We wouldn't have well-equipped new hospitals because Medicare pays for their equipment. We wouldn't have medical specialists the way we do now because Medicare funds their training. And we wouldn't have these private insurance companies, which are the focus of the debate because it's a huge tax subsidy for employment-based insurance and various regulatory favors that have created them as they are today.
Let me get, it looks like Phil from Unionville to join us. And Phil, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
How is everyone?
Pretty good.
Good. I'm a small businessman. I have a law firm that employs three people, and I previously only had coverage for my family, but I would like to now get coverage through my firm. And the signals out there are very confusing as to whether or not I can do so. And at this juncture, if so, how do I do so?
Well, first of all, Phil, I think it's great that you want to do so. Let me see what Sarah Cliff has to say. Sarah, what does a small business person like Phil do?
Yeah, the small business arena, you have plenty of reason to be confused because it's one of the areas that has had the most delays and challenges launching. I can tell you that where we are right now is that just this past Wednesday, right before Thanksgiving, the federal government announced that it will not have online enrollment for small businesses in 2014, that you will have to wait until 2015. You do have the option, if you'd like to purchase one of the plans through the exchange, to go to a broker or navigator, and they can help you through that process. One of the advantages of buying through the marketplace is there is a tax credit for businesses with fewer than 25 employees that could cover up to 50% of the cost of premiums for the people that you're covering. And that's only accessible if you're buying plans through the exchange. So if that is something that's interesting to you, the best way to do that is to look for a broker. Unfortunately, I mean, it is, I will admit, it is a challenge right now because the online enrollment is not ready. But what the White House has said is they're hoping people will go to brokers and navigators and try and sign up that way.
Robert, he's calling us from Pennsylvania, where we are.
Yeah. I think basically Sarah described the situation where these small business exchanges will be open. The subsidies will be available. That's the most important part. But you won't have the advantage of the website. You won't be able to compare the policies graphically the way they envision someday. Mm-hmm. But you can still get that coverage for your employees. And I think it's great he's going to do that.
Well, and thanks for the call, Phil. And again, we're almost up on another break here. Our local insurance companies, and I'm looking at you, Robert Field, yeah, especially in Pennsylvania, which is, you know, the government, that they didn't want the government plan. Are they kind of stepping into the breach here?
It seems like Independence Blue Cross, our dominant insurer, is very much on board. You recall up until this summer, their advertising campaign was Changing the Game, which was a clear reference to health reform. And even now, Live Fearless, that sort of semi-ungrammatical slogan of theirs that you see all over, is trying to get the young Invincibles to sign up. And Aetna has been one of the key players on the insurance company side in promoting this and trying to facilitate the new market. So our two dominant insurers have been on board.
And that's Robert Field, who joins us along with Sarah Cliff. And again, we're getting an update, a bit of a reality check on the Affordable Care Act and the, I guess, the relaunch or the improved launch of the healthcare.gov website. And we're taking calls from at 1-888-477-9499, I guess from you at WHYY.org as well. So do stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
The University City Science Center supports WHYY. In Greater Philadelphia, innovation means business, and the Science Center is at the core of that business. They unite our region's entrepreneurial ecosystem, convening the resources, funders, and people that move ideas forward. For more than 50 years, the Science Center has helped transform ambition into success, fueling the growth that strengthens our region. The University City Science Center. More information at sciencecenter.org. That's sciencecenter.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Alexander Payne, the director of Election, Sideways, and The Descendants, talks about his new movie, Nebraska. The cast includes Nebraskans who look and sound authentic but had never acted before.
It was a long process of putting out casting notices on, for example, rural radio after the farm report.
Really? Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
The Journal American Psychologist published a special issue on peace psychology. It contends the science of psychology plays a vital role in the promotion of peace. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, we'll hear from three authors who contributed to the journal, their thoughts on building peaceful communities, de-radicalization, and how truth can be the first casualty of war. Today at noon, right here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. The White House pledged that their troubled healthcare website would work more smoothly come December 1st. And according to the official spearheading repairs to the site, it's vastly improved from its debut 2 months ago, with work still to be done. And again, talking with Sarah Cliff, who covers health policy for the Washington Post, blogs at Health Reform Watch. Also with Robert Field, a professor at Drexel University School of Public Health, author of a new book called Mother of Invention, and he blogs at philly.com, The Field Clinic, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Send us an you can also send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org. Robert and I were talking during the break about the Supreme Court deciding to weigh in on this provision, I guess, for employers having to do with health care plans that cover contraception. Can you break that down for us?
So the law says that preventive services that are approved by a certain U.S. panel have to be covered in full with no copay or deductible. One of those is contraception. And there are a number of companies across the country that claim that this violates their religious beliefs. They don't believe in contraceptive. The main one, Hobby Lobby, says it's only those that they think impair the implantation of a fertilized egg. But in any case, they all have religious objections. So they want that piece to be stripped from the law. Mm. On the one hand, that would not be fatal to the law. It's one requirement. If that were not part of it, you'd still have 99% of it working smoothly. On the other hand, it is an extremely emotional issue, and it has huge implications beyond Obamacare for how much the government can impose requirements for the public good that interfere with individuals' religious beliefs, and how can those beliefs be expressed through a corporation, which is unexplored legal territory.
Which has to do whether corporations are people, too? I mean, does it get us into that argument?
Whether they're not just people, but religious people.
Or just people on top of that. Sarah, anything you want to add to that piece of this Affordable Care Act provision?
Yeah, the only thing I would add here, I think Robert did an excellent job summarizing, you know, the issue is that for anyone kind of thinking about the Affordable Care Act going back to the Supreme Court, that this provision, while it is important, it is not going to affect the law's overall trajectory. This isn't like the individual mandate, which was seen as kind of holding the whole law together. This is one provision that, you know, very strongly supported by supporters of the Affordable Care Act, but if the Supreme Court does rule that it's unconstitutional, it's not going to bring down the rest of the law with it.
But it does. Yeah, go ahead.
No, but we have other challenges out there that could be more serious. We could be seeing June as the annual health care month before the Supreme Court.
Every June when they do their ruling.
Yeah, indefinitely.
But it's interesting when you look back at the history of Medicare, and it had a difficult rollout, and there certainly were criticisms. But now it seems, although people do criticize it, when you find out, oftentimes people criticize it also get Medicare for themselves,
right,
or for their mom or for their dad. But that does seem more settled, and it does raise questions, Robert, whether the Affordable Care Act will ever become the kind of settled law that other parts of our healthcare system have.
So I think the odds are that it will. You saw Medicare with the same rollout, the prescription drug benefit, the Massachusetts Romney Care, which was the model for health reform. And I think Obama's got about 3 years to go in his presidency. I think the odds are by the time his presidency is done, the kinks will be worked out and people will begin to accept this as part of the woodwork. Mm-hmm. The problem he faces, I think, is the midterm elections next year. if this causes the Democrats to lose a lot of ground in Congress, the Republicans could make it that much harder, and that could challenge his ability to complete the deal.
And Sarah, one already hears Democrats getting kind of nervous, you know, looking ahead to next year about how closely they want to tie themselves to Obama and the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah, I think you see some of that already, and I think the point to assess will be at the end of open enrollment when we get to March, and that's the last point when people can sign up. And, you know, how well are things going then? I think that'll have more of a political impact than how well things are going right now. One thing I wanted to follow up on Robert's point about previous healthcare programs, a few months ago I went back into the Washington Post archives and looked at our papers from 1965 and 66 when Medicare was launching, and it was really fascinating for me to see that there was so much uncertainty around the program at that point, that we had this great front page story from the mid-1960s where this worker for Medicare was going around trying to sign seniors up, and no one wanted to sign up for it. They just wouldn't come to the door. He could see them peeking out of their windows and not coming out. And there was just so much uncertainty around it, and it's something it's easy to lose track of because, you know, decades later, it's a beloved program that, you know, you regularly get very high remarks, and, you know, everyone wants to keep Medicare. And it was just really interesting perspective to go back and look and realize that there was actually, you know, certain Washington Post articles that were written about the launch of Medicare and these questions of will people sign up and will they like it, that those were actually really real questions in the 1960s.
And the fact that people still knocked, or I guess back then, you probably weren't born there, Sarah, people knocked on other people's doors to sign them up for things.
They did. It was a little bit different. They actually had some fascinating stories about they were trying to literally reach everyone under over 65, and they were sending people, you know, out on snowmobiles to find people in very rural areas of Alaska. Luckily, we have the internet now, so that is something the administration does have on its side.
Indeed.
Plus, the AMA threatened a physician boycott when it first came out because they thought this was socialized medicine that was going to control the practice of medicine. And today, with all the disputes, most physicians rely on Medicare for most of their income.
Let me ask you about a possible doctor shortage. And do you see that, assuming more people sign up and the system gets up and running in the couple of years that you have predicted here?
Yeah, well, we certainly saw that in Massachusetts when they did the prototype for this. So I think we can expect it to happen here. You'll have millions of more people with coverage. And usually the first thing they do is go out to see a primary care doctor to get all their ailments checked, to have checkups and so forth. So that's definitely going to be part of the scenario. In Massachusetts, that sort of the pig worked its way through the python and eventually it evened itself out. And I don't think there's a major shortage issue now. But the next few years, there definitely will be. If you have a good primary care doctor, you're not going to lose that relationship. But if you need a new one, that could be a challenge.
Let me see what John from Brigantine, New Jersey has to say. John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. I've been trying to get health care through this program. When I was finally able to get through a series of problems, the website being down, and they still can't set me up with the password. When they finally told me what I qualified for, they're telling me it would cost me $488 a month if I buy through them. I'm only making $9 an hour at my job. Where do they feel that's affordable income? The rep online told me, for some reason, I didn't qualify for the subsidy or cost sharing. You know, I just don't understand what's going on with this website if it's supposed to be set up for people in my position, barely making minimum wage.
And you work at a full-time job, and that's your job, John, basically making $9 an hour?
Yeah, after being out of work for almost 4 years, that's the only job I could find.
Well, let me see what our guests have to say, because obviously that's a lot of money for someone making $9 an hour. Robert, do you want to give this a crack?
I'm surprised he was told that he's not eligible for a subsidy. I would ask the caller, if you're still on, is your income yours alone, or are there other members of your household that contribute to the household income?
No, I'm a single white male that's been out of work for 4.5 years, trying to get back on my feet. When I first applied, got onto the website when it was up, I did see where it told me that my premiums would maybe run me 75 or 80 through the site, but now I can't get back to that because of problems with it. And the reason I went for it is because it would be a lot cheaper than what my workplace wants to charge us for health care.
Yeah, and let me
all they could tell me is write a letter of appeal, and hopefully they'll do something.
Yeah, John, let me toss it down to Sarah and see if she can help you out here. Sarah, what are your thoughts?
So it's hard to know on any specific situation, but, you know, it sounds like something isn't quite right here. One thing, you know, it might be worth looking into is whether you qualify for the Medicaid program. If you earn less than $15,000 a year, there's a decent chance that you would qualify for that. The other thing to know is that we have heard some reports of inaccurate subsidy determinations, that people are not getting the right subsidy that they are supposed to qualify for. Some of this is problems on the back end, and some of this is on the front end, that, you know, there's different ways to enter your salary, whether it be monthly, yearly, hourly, and some of that, they've had some trouble making sure that that information is entered accurately. But it sounds like, as someone you, New Jersey, you said you were in New Jersey?
Yep, New Jersey.
Okay, so New Jersey is expanding Medicaid, so there really shouldn't be a coverage gap there. That someone earning $9 an hour should certainly be eligible for some type of financial help.
And would it make sense to go to a navigator when something doesn't seem right?
Yeah,
I think so.
Oh. So someone that knows how the system is supposed to work and can walk you through it. John, we wish you best of luck, and hopefully you can get that squared away. We have an email, someone wanting to know, and this is to you, Robert, about Pennsylvania's Medicaid expansion. Where does Pennsylvania sit on this issue, or stand when it comes to this issue?
Basically nowhere. Governor Corbett has proposed a unusual form of expansion. It's loosely modeled on what the state of Arkansas did, although it's got some substantial differences. Before he can implement it, the federal government has to approve. There's a good chance the federal government will not approve. Even if it does, the earliest this would go into effect is 2015. So there's a good chance that Pennsylvania is not going to expand Medicaid. That is, unless there's a different governor in 2015.
Interesting. Let me see what Susie from Maple Glen has to say. Susie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
My question is, I have some very conservative friends who get a lot of information from conservative talk shows, and they're telling me that Michelle Obama is profiting, or not Michelle herself, her friend is profiting from the website that is being used for this. And I never can find any information on it to verify this.
And this looks like her college friend? I'm looking at the computer here.
Yes, I believe that's what they said.
Sarah, have you been tracking some of these allegations?
Yeah, I'm aware of kind of this idea that's been going around. So there's a woman who went to Princeton at the same time as Michelle Obama, who is an executive at CGI, which is one of the contractors building healthcare.gov. That's as much as we know about their connection. We don't have any evidence that they knew each other at Princeton or that they were friends. From what I understand, both of them might have been involved in the, you know, Association of Black Alumni of Princeton. But aside from that, we don't have much evidence that these two people were friends or even came in contact when they were at Princeton.
Susie, I hope that takes care of that for you. Robert Field, I don't know if you've been tracking some outlandish allegations about the Affordable Care Act?
Beyond the death panels.
That's one, right?
I guess we've moved beyond the idea that a panel of people or panels of people were going to decide which seniors would live and which die. When you get something as complicated as this with private companies involved, you're inevitably going to have companies that have connections to government officials and so forth. That's not good, but there's no way to avoid it. I think the overriding issue is getting the website to work. If this were functioning, then the rumors and so forth would not get the credence that they get, and we'd just be signing up for coverage.
We have an email from Catherine. She is on a guaranteed issue health insurance plan in Pennsylvania, and she's thrilled with the Affordable Care Act. I mean, there's stories all over the map here.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. For all the people who are angry about canceled coverage, there are lots of people who are happy to be able to go on real coverage. So that part of it has not been played up so far. I think if they were able to sign up, you'd see a different media spin to this.
Sarah, a couple minutes before we have to say goodbye, so what will you be looking at or looking for, let's say, over the next couple of weeks, especially with this website?
I think we'll be looking to see if people are having the experience that the administration thinks they are, that the administration has said most people should have an easy time signing up at this point, and we're going to be talking to people to see if that's the case. The other thing that Robert and I both touched on before is how things are going for insurance companies. At the end of the day, this is all about being able to go to the doctor and have someone pay your bill. And we'll be watching that period in early January as people start going to the doctor to see if, their insurance has taken effect, if they have the plan they think they have, and they are, successfully submitting claims to the insurance company. I think those are two key things to watch over this next month.
And what will you be watching for, Robert?
I think what Sarah mentioned, I think in January, are people getting real coverage, and are they now getting health care they couldn't get before? The dream for Obama would be press stories about people saying, I got to see the doctor, I could never do that before, I got all these serious ailments checked out. The nightmare, of course, is that doesn't happen, that they couldn't get into the doctor because the insurance company had no record of what went on. So I think the next month or so of that back-end work is absolutely crucial.
And even looking down the pike, this I'll toss to you, Robert Field, our final point here having to do with whether this Affordable Care Act will bring down the cost of health care. I know it has been coming down in recent years. I'm not sure exactly why, but do you think, and that's part of the goal, is to make healthcare more affordable?
Yeah. Well, it's certainly in the title there, and it's certainly a goal, but it's a subsidiary goal. And, in health policy, we talk about the competing goals of cost, quality, and access. And we generally say that you can't improve more than one or two at most without hurting the third. So this is all about access. I think costs are very much at risk here. I think in the long run, some of the experiments like accountable care organizations will help to bring down costs. But in the short run, I'm not sure it's going to have that much of an effect.
On that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Robert Field, thank you very much. And Sarah Cliff, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
And she covers health policy for the Washington Post. You can check out her blog, Health Reform Watch. Robert Field, again, professor of health management and policy at Drexel University's School of Public Health here in Philadelphia. Also a lecturer in healthcare management at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Author of a new book called Mother of Invention, How the Government Created Free Market Healthcare. And he blogs at philly.com, The Field Clinic. Go to whyy.org/radiotime. And you can check us out as well. I'm Marty Moscow, and thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.